Hello and welcome. I'm Claire and you're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast by the Microbiology Society. In the latest edition of Microbiology Today, we launched our brand new project, Knocking Out AMR. So for the next two episodes of Microbe Talk, we're bringing you conversations with our members who are working in antimicrobial resistance. For this episode, I spoke to Professor Chloe James from the University of Salford. As well as investigating the use of phages as alternative therapeutics, Chloe is researching the spread of antimicrobial resistance in Uganda through the charity Knowledge for Change, alongside Makerere University and colleagues from the Infectious Disease Institute in Uganda. Chloe was also the chair of the Impact and Influence Committee at the Society and is now part of the Knocking Out AMR Project Oversight Group.
Hi, I'm Professor Chloe James. I'm at the University of Salford and I'm a medical microbiologist. I've been a lecturer there for about 10 years now.
Perfect. And so you have a research role. Could you tell me about your research?
Yeah, so as a microbiologist, I've got lots of different research projects going on. I think you can't be a microbiologist without really being passionate about the challenge of antimicrobial resistance. So some of our work, we have connections in the west of Uganda, looking at the rates of antimicrobial resistance in Staphylococcus aureus in a fairly rural area, so away from the capital of Kampala. We did a study in Fort Portal Regional Referral Hospital. And we worked with their microbiology team there, just looking at the antibiotic resistance profiles of the bacteria that they collected from wounds. And that what that study really showed us was that there are some incredibly resistant bacteria out there. So it was the data was really stark, saying that there were a lot of pan-resistant bacteria that really can't be treated with. Well, there's very few antibiotics that we have left that they could be treated with. But what it also showed us was the major challenge in lower middle income country settings where they're really poorly resourced. And so their stocks of antibiotics were low and would run out before they got more. But also their resources for doing antimicrobial testing and surveillance was quite low. So that work I found really, really interesting on the ground, just seeing how severe the problem is and how we need a lot of people to gather together to tackle the problem.
Yeah, definitely. So there's lots to talk about there. That's fantastic. I suppose my first question, just to track back for everybody who's listening, antimicrobial resistance, what is that?
So antimicrobial resistance is a really massive term, and it can be broken down. So antimicrobial resistance is really the problem of any microorganisms no longer being susceptible to antimicrobial drugs. As a bacteriologist, I'm mainly interested in bacteria. So I'm talking about, when I say AMR, I'm really talking about bacteria being resistant to antibiotics.
Yeah.
And what that means is that some, I guess in the past we might have called them straightforward bacterial diseases that could easily be treated with antibiotics. That's no longer the case. So a lot of the antibiotics we have are unable to treat more and more bacterial infections.
And so antimicrobial resistance is such a worldwide problem. It will likely affect everybody. So it's interesting you're talking about this kind of international collaboration in your research. Why is, I suppose that's one of the reasons, but why else is international collaboration so important when kind of tackling this antimicrobial resistant crisis?
So, I mean, we're a global society now, aren't we?
Yeah.
And I think that it's well recognised that AMR poses this catastrophic threat that's on a global scale. And because we all travel internationally, there's a lot of mobility around the world. Trying to tackle the problem in just one country is kind of pointless.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really, really important that we have a look at this on a global scale and that we work together. And also that we recognise that the challenges are different in different settings. I think that we can actually, learn quite a lot from frugal innovations in places like Uganda. Because, of course, the UK, we think of the UK as being a rich country, but actually, if you take London out of the picture, there are a lot of areas of poverty in the UK. And I think that there is a lot that we can learn bilaterally. I think there's a lot that we can give to places like Uganda, but there's a lot that we can learn from them as well.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think there's potentially this kind of quite often a criticism of some areas of science is this Eurocentric perception of what science is and what can be considered science. So, yeah, like you said, taking those alternative options, and it's not just a one-sided relationship. You can learn so much from both directions.
Absolutely.
I'm happy you said that like that, yeah. So also what you touched on in your research that's going on in Uganda at the moment is surveillance. So why is surveillance of antimicrobial resistance so important?
Well, I think that we have to accept that everybody and everything is different all over the world, and we can't just assume that the same patterns of resistance and the same mechanisms of resistance are happening everywhere all of the time, particularly in areas of poor resource settings. They'll be using different types of antibiotics, and so we need to know, really, to try and better understand what the drivers of antimicrobial resistance are and how the use of antibiotics is driving different types of resistance. Then we need to gather that data. And of course, there is a huge amount of data, particularly from places like the US and the UK. But in places like sub-Saharan Africa, there are actually lots of grey areas where there really isn't a huge amount of data, particularly in the rural areas, where behaviours and stewardship procedures are quite different. And there's a lot of other cultural issues that come in. So it's really important that we gather that data so that we can really drill down and understand the problem as best we can.
You mentioned types of resistance. Is that the mechanisms of the bacteria becoming resistant?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So different antibiotics work in different ways, and they specifically target different types of bacterial biology. And obviously, bacteria have been around for billions of years, and they invented antibiotics, right?
Yeah.
And they've been evolving all of these different mechanisms, these different ways that they can resist antibiotics so they can compete with each other. And I think we've probably only really scratched the surface. I think there's a lot more innovation there in bacterial physiology that we don't even know about yet. But for those mechanisms that we do know about, we now have several different ways that we can identify those and look to see how that changes across the world.
Got you. So the surveillance, it's working out your enemy, I suppose, and gathering as much information as you can, but it's also targeting and informing your response as well.
Yeah, absolutely, because as well as the sort of molecular biology side of understanding how the resistance works and how it develops, I think that it's our responsibility as microbiologists to work with others to help with education and to understand behaviours and look to see how we can use data as evidence to help to change behaviours, to be smarter about how we use antibiotics.
So I'm guessing that's where your social scientist kind of partner then comes in. And it's a bit more of a, it's not just a research project, it's a sort of, I suppose, a full 360 approach to the problem of AMR in Uganda.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very involved in outreach events, both in the UK and Uganda. And so as an educator, I obviously do a lot of teaching as well. I'm always looking for innovative ways that we can get threshold concepts across and help people to understand sometimes quite complex microbiological concepts. Yeah, and even if you haven't had, 20 years of training, I think that we can find ways to help people understand AMR. And so that's what we've been trying to do with a lot of our outreach and public engagement activities.
Yeah, interesting. So, I don't know, perhaps maybe a cynic may say, what can one individual do in terms of this massive crisis? I'm not a doctor who prescribes antibiotics. I'm just a regular person. I mean, what's your response to that?
Well, I think that, you know, just conversation with all kinds of different people is really important. As an individual, you can be a bit smarter about the antibiotics that you use. So you can maybe not take antibiotics if you don't need them. Or if you do need them, you can make sure that you take them properly. So as an individual, there's some things that we can do to preserve the efficacy of antibiotics. But it's also about infection prevention control. So things like hygiene and hand washing and preventing the spread of infections through communities. So again, every individual has a responsibility there. But I think the other thing is that, especially with the younger generations that might not know if they're going to be scientists yet or not, any conversation that you have out at parties with taxi drivers, down the shops, you're spreading the word about antimicrobial resistance. And the more sort of social conscience there is about being careful about antibiotics, then who knows, these people might end up being policymakers that will make an absolutely massive difference.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good point, definitely. I mean, do you think maybe that as a society, COVID maybe has been a bit of a help in terms of talking about kind of AMR and working together? Or has it been a hindrance? What are your thoughts?
I think it's been a help. I think obviously COVID has been really damaging, and the intricate problems that it has spread are, we could talk for 8 billion hours on.
We could. Yeah.
I do think that there's an increased social conscience about science and data and trying to unpick the data and understand what it really means and how it affects us. So I think in some cases it's made some people thirsty for more information and want to talk to scientists to find out the issue. I think on the flip side, it's made some people really fed up and tired and scared and want to hide away from the science and don't want to hear anything anymore. And, you know, everybody's different, of course. But I think as microbiologists, we have to see it as an opportunity to talk to the people that want to talk to us. And if they want to find out more, to help them to understand that data better.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So I suppose it's, you know, it's a huge crisis. It's a worldwide problem. It's something that's going to have a huge amount of kind of working together to be able to tackle. But it is not complete all doom and gloom. There are some alternatives of ways that scientists, microbiologists, everybody's working together to combat antimicrobial resistance. Could you tell me about these kind of alternative therapeutics?
Yes, I would love to. So a much bigger part of my research is actually on bacteriophages. Mm-hmm. Now, bacteriophages are viruses, but nothing like COVID. Mm-hmm. They are viruses that are actually, I mean, people probably know that viruses are very, very specific and they will only target certain cells. Mm. Well, bacteriophages only target bacteria. Not only do they only target bacteria, but they only target very specific bacteria. So they're quite precision weapons. Mm-hmm. And what they do is when they recognize their target bacterium, they will infect it, replicate inside it, burst it open, killing it, and then releasing new viruses that can go on and kill more of their target bacteria. So we've known about phages for over 100 years,
yeah.
And they have been applied as, but we call this phage therapy, so they've been applied as phage therapy for almost as long. But it's not been a very exact science, and so it's one of, because they're so specific, phage therapy works amazingly when it works,
yeah.
But when it doesn't work, it does nothing. So I'm really excited to be involved in phage research now, though, because the technology has really advanced over the last sort of 10 or 20 years. Mm. And I feel like there's a real head of steam building on phage research now that we have a lot more power with things like genome sequencing and bioinformatics, but also synthetic biology and genetic engineering. Meaning that now, more than ever, we're understanding how phages interact with bacteria. Mm. And we're starting to really make some very good progress in tailoring phages to be able to target the bacteria that are really causing massive, massive problems, so particularly the multi-drug resistant bacteria.
Yeah. So is that your sort of, I suppose, target to start off with, is the most dangerous sort of multi-resistant bacteria?
I think so. So, I mean, this year, the government launched an inquiry into the use of bacteriophages as antimicrobial agents. Mm. And they started hearing evidence towards the end of last year, and they finished hearing all of the evidence now, and we're waiting on their response. But I think the government is really interested in phages as part of the solution to AMR. And so they're particularly interested in those multi-drug resistant bacteria. And there have been some quite high profile stories of late with some real successes of really managing to clear some of the big baddies.
Mm, that's good. So I think I've come across phages before, and it's definitely my complete misunderstanding of how it works. So I'm just like, well, if it's a virus that kills a bacteria, just chuck them all in. Like, what are the kind of key hindrances in using phage therapy?
So there's big challenges in getting phage therapy right, and we're really not quite there yet, but I'm really excited that we might be soon. Some of the challenges are, I mean, they're a massive untapped resource, so there's absolutely billions of them out there. They're the most abundant organism on the planet. But finding the right one that will kill the bacterium that you're after is quite difficult. Mm. And of course, there's so many different strains out there that usually you need to have a cocktail of, you know, 6 or 7 phages that could target different strains, so that you can use them effectively across a population.
Mm.
But there's big regulatory challenges with that, because in order to license a medicine, you need to be able to really clearly define exactly what's in it.
Yeah.
And because phages are sort of replicating entities, they can evolve. And also, when you constantly have to tailor your cocktail to fit the right targets. And so there's a lot of sort of financial and regulatory challenges around being able to produce them to the right manufacturing standards to be allowed to use them. Mm. And so that's a big problem. I think that the other problem that I got to talk about is that not all phages efficiently kill bacteria.
Oh, right, okay.
So my specific area of research is on a group of phages called temperate bacteriophages. They infect their target bacterium in the same way as virulent phages, which is the ones that we focus on for phage therapy. They inject their DNA into the target bacterium, but then that DNA becomes integrated into the bacterial chromosome, and they form a partnership with their bacterial host. So a lot of temperate phages actually can coexist with their bacterium over a long period of time and can help them to evolve and to adapt better to their environment. So some of these phages can actually make bacteria more difficult to treat and sometimes cause more severe disease. So it's really, really important that we understand that nuance and to be able to distinguish between those different types of phages.
Mm, interesting. Okay, so it's quite clearly not just a slap it in situation. There's quite a lot.
No, but I'm so excited to be involved in this research area at the moment because the possibilities are being blown right open by things like genetic engineering, where we can take the bits of the phage that work well and take away the bits of the phage that don't work well, so that we can make this real precision tool.
Mm.
But I think a lot of we also need a lot of public engagement in that arena, because there's a lot of misunderstandings and misgivings and fear about viruses, about genetic modification. And so I think that we really, really need quite desperately to talk quite in depth to lots of people from different aspects of society to see what people think about phages.
Definitely. I think you started sort of speaking of, you know, GM foods, for example. There's this huge kind of fear around things like that. So I suppose the messages that you're putting out there have to be so carefully put together. So is part of your kind of public engagement involved in that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So over the last couple of years, we've been really ramping up our public engagement.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really lucky because at Salford University, we've got quite an interdisciplinary team. And lots of computer scientists and animators and experts in digital media And so we've done, we've developed a couple of virtual reality experiences.
Oh, wow.
Sort of full virtual reality, but also augmented reality and big immersive experiences where people can really immerse themselves in an environment to understand a threshold concept. Mm. And so my particular area of interest is in cystic fibrosis,
okay,
which is a genetic disorder that causes people to be highly susceptible to respiratory infections. And so they tend to suffer really chronic and lifelong severe bacterial infections that's quite complicated with lots of different bacteria all working together and fungi and viruses. And we've been investigating where bacteriophages sit in that. So I work with a team from Liverpool University, some of whom are developing possible virulent phages as possible phage therapy, but others that are trying to understand how these temperate phages interact with bacteria in complex situations.
Mm.
So what we've done, we've created a virtual reality lung so people can go immerse themselves in a lung, learn about these chronic infections that can happen, and look in the experience they go through how different types of phages can sometimes kill certain bacteria, how resistance can develop, how temperate phages can sometimes complicate the situation. And we find that really helps people to understand the context of what we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose it's giving a kind of real life situation in which they're aware of how it could potentially work. So I suppose if they then perhaps have opinions about policy, for example, later on down the line about phage therapy, they can draw back to that individual experience, which I think is really effective.
Absolutely. And it does trigger a lot of conversations afterwards, mm, because particularly in the cystic fibrosis world, so to people with CF know that they have a shorter life expectancy than normal and tend to be very, very well read on the disease and the different types of treatments that are coming up. And some people are quite excited about the idea of phage therapy because there have been some big success stories in that area recently. But I think it's important that we manage expectations because actually we're not yet in a situation where if someone has a chronic infection, we've got the magic phage formula that will definitely work.
Yeah.
So I think having conversations on that level is important, but also on the level of just getting people excited about science,
yeah,
and wanting to kind of come up with their own solutions, really. So we also have some interactive models that we make in our makerspace at Salford. They're 3D printed, and we've got these absolute massive giant bacterial models that are sort of about the size and weight of a baby. My babies. These are working models where people can take phages and try and find the right phage to infect the bacterium. And if they get the right one, it pops open a bit like pop-up pirate, releasing more phages. Or sometimes it doesn't. It actually grows superpowers and it shows how some phages can help bacteria adapt to their environment. So I think as well as the sort of virtual reality where it's a bit of a passive experience, we've got these really like active learning tools as well. That people can really get to grips with. And I think that they really help with a younger audience as well.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, it's so important to kind of have these sort of engagement activities for people to be able to also understand science so that they're not fearful of it, but also understand the limitations of science. I've not quite kind of thought about it in that way before, of just kind of, I suppose, making them aware of kind of what you're doing and how hard it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important that we don't oversell this and say everybody's saved and we don't need to worry because we've got phages. I think that phages are definitely going to be part of the solution, and it's a really exciting time to be a phage researcher. But we have to remember that this has to be a multi-sector, multi-discipline, global effort to tackle AMR that is going to have lots and lots of different parts that all work together to find new solutions. And I think a big part of that is exciting the younger population to want to become scientists and to trust that, you know, it's it's really a worthwhile career move to become a scientist and to really come up with these solutions.
Yeah, yeah, and to show the creativity of science as well. It's about thinking about solutions. And I think potentially sometimes the way that kids sort of approach science in schools, it's very written down, it's very like learned by book. But actually you're problem solving, I suppose, at the bare minimum kind of bottom level of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really glad you said creativity, because when I was very little, I wanted to live on a hill, do ballet and paint pictures. And I was quite a creative person, and I really sort of, I love science, but I was quite sad because I thought I was leaving art behind. And actually, I'm bringing art and creativity more and more into my practice now, and seeing just how important it is and how valuable art is in the world of science.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, not only is multidisciplinary working kind of at this, you know, in your research really important, but also you're a multidisciplinary person too, and you can provide that experience and into the work that you do, which is also so important.
Absolutely. And we worked with our students just last year in animation and digital media. So these are not scientists at all. But I had a lecture with them where I talked all about phage and waxed lyrical about all of the different ways that phages and bacteria interact. And for their final assessment, they each had to produce an animation that's inspired by this story. And their creativity was absolutely awesome. And they came up with really diverse ways to put the story across that I never would have thought of in a billion years. And they had all of these character developments and narrative arcs that really enriched my excitement about my work and really helped me to tell stories to other people from all different walks of life.
I suppose kind of turning it ever so slightly, you touched on it before about kind of policy and the phage response from the government. Why is it so important to then also engage with policymakers when we're talking about the antimicrobial resistance crisis?
I think that the government plays a massive role in tackling antimicrobial resistance, because at the center, ultimately they hold the purse strings. Mm. And we desperately need more money to be able to develop solutions. But obviously they don't have this endless pot of money. And so it's really important that policymakers understand where that money is going to be better spent. Mm. And this has to be a continual bilateral conversation that we have. And the more understanding that we have in government and in sort of people with positions of decision of power and people that have the power to make these decisions, we need them to understand on a basic level. Mm. We don't want them to become expert scientists. They don't have to know everything. But just so that we've got the same language, so that we can talk to each other, so that that money can be best spent rather than spewed somewhere where actually it's not making that big a difference. Mm. And so I think, you know, as microbiologists, it's really important that we're not scared to talk to policymakers, and that we're not scared to get out of the lab and not only get into museums and schools and talk to the public, but actually get into businesses and companies mm. and governments and talk to them so that we can work together on the challenge.
I've got one last question, but I wanted to track back before that last question. So we talked about kind of alternative therapeutics and how important surveillance is. I realised that we hadn't touched on diagnostics and how important that is. Mm. I suppose, could you give me like a brief overview, I suppose, of what diagnostic options we have available to us at the moment, and perhaps kind of what the future of that is looking like?
So every country across, well, maybe not every country, but lots of countries across the globe have developed strategies for how we're going to tackle AMR. Mm. And the UK has a big 20-year plan at the moment, and it has these ambitions for change and these major targets. And one of those major targets is in diagnostics. So it's a very threshold concept that antibiotics are useless at treating viral infections, for example. Mm. But how do you know if you've got a viral infection? Well, if we have better diagnostic tools, even simple ones that can distinguish if your infection is caused by a virus or caused by a bacterium, then that can massively reduce the amount of unnecessary antibiotics that are being used. And then that can preserve our antibiotics that do still work, because some of them do still work and we do still rely on them and desperately need them. And so to preserve that, if we have more accurate diagnostic tools that are firstly more accurate but also more rapid, so that we can get the right treatment at the right time, then that's a big, big, big part of tackling AMR. So I'm not an expert in diagnostics, and so my knowledge of exactly which ones are out there is a little bit ropey.
Better than mine.
But obviously, but you know, things that in my mind have been a big success is the lateral flow test for COVID. And so that technology exists, and if that can be used for differentiating other things, so I know there's a diagnostic tool for recognising from a sore throat if that's caused by streptococcus or by a virus. And so rapid diagnostic tests like that, that people can do at home and do a quick test, could be really, really useful. Of course, no one wants to wake up in the morning and do 20 different tests to see if they're infected with anything. But I think in GP surgeries and possibly in pharmacies as well, so people not necessarily having to go to their GP, diagnostics like that could really, really, really help. And bringing it back to phage, there's some people that are actually using phages as precision diagnostic tools now as well, which is really exciting.
Yeah, and I suppose that just then kind of ties in quite well to this kind of mentality, sort of, if you've got an answer, kind of a you know, on paper answer that your infection is a virus, we can't give you antibiotics, it kind of, at the personal level of the person who's not very well, makes it easier for you to then be like, okay, well, that's how it works. Rather than if you don't know, you're going to be like, no, I need you to treat me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I definitely feel, and obviously I don't have the data to support this, this is just my life experiences, that in the UK we've done all right at managing people's expectations about antibiotics. And I think that quite a lot of society is comfortable now with their GP saying, this is a virus, drink plenty of water, have some rest, have some paracetamol, you don't need antibiotics. I don't think that's the same everywhere. I think that, you know, I've lived in several other countries where there's still really an expectation that if you go to your GP, you want antibiotics.
Yeah.
And having some sort of diagnostic tool that can show people you do not need antibiotics because they're not going to work, I think could be really, really strong.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, that's amazing. I've learned so much. Thank you so much. But my final question, and approach this however you'd like, but what changes would you like to see in the next sort of 10 years or so when it comes to, I don't know, AMR policy or research or public understanding? If there was like a personal goal for you, what would that be?
I mean, there's so many changes I would like to see. obviously there's money. I would like to see there being a lot more funding for research into new diagnostics, into new antimicrobial discovery, and also in basic science to understand how bacteria and viruses interact with humans and animals. So obviously a big boost in funding, but I would also like to really see a lot more interaction between business and science and industry and science, so that we can find sort of better economic ways to develop new drugs. I don't know exactly how you do that, but I think it's really important that, that, you know, we're talking with clinicians and with industry partners, so that we're not just sitting in our academic ivory towers feeling clever about ourselves and making sure that, that our research has impact. And I think that has happened a lot, to be honest, over the last 10 or 20 years, but I think we can do a lot more. And I would really like to see kids in schools across the country, particularly schools that might be poorly resourced, feeling excited about science and feeling like they could be scientists and that they have it in their capacity to be part of the solution.
Yeah. And I suppose a big, it would be silly for me not to mention that a big part of this kind of future that you're looking into could be influenced quite heavily by the Impact and Influence Committee at the Microbiology Society. You were the chair of the committee. Could you tell me a little bit about your time in that role?
I'm really proud to be part of the Microbiology Society, and I loved my term as chair of the Impact and Influence Committee. I really loved how it helped me to get involved with so many of their different activities and have influence across the UK and Ireland, but also beyond that. Mm. It really empowered me to be able to think that I could influence policy and people. And so I think that the Microbiology Society has a massive role, particularly nationally, but actually across the globe now as well. They have this big project that they're launching called Knocking Out AMR. And I'm really happy to have been invited back to be part of the steering committee of that project. And this is a big, ambitious project, pulling together lots of people from different areas across the world to tackle AMR. And the drive of that is to really focus on positive solutions and how we can have impact in key areas like diagnostics and vaccines and novel therapeutics, but also surveillance and also global conversations. Mm. And we're really hoping that there can be a big kind of showcase of this work in the near future that brings lots and lots of people together. So I'm really, really excited about that project.
Yes, fabulous. Could you tell me, so what is your role within the kind of Knocking Out AMR project? Where do you sort of fit into it?
Yes, I'm really excited to come back officially and be part of an oversight group of this new exciting project called Knocking Out AMR. So there's lots of groups that are looking at different aspects to come up with real strong solutions for AMR. And in the oversight committee, our role will be to look at that as a whole and make sure that that's all joined up and make sure that we can report on it and really get the best out of the whole project. So I'm really excited to be able to have a role in steering that.
Fabulous, fabulous. I think I've asked you so many questions. Thank you so much for bringing
it. It's because we go down so many avenues that you forget so many things I'm saying.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to Chloe for joining me on this episode of Microbe Talk. If you'd like to know more about her research, you can do so by following the links in the description. If you're interested in taking part in the Knocking Out AMR project at the Society, please visit our website or click the link in the description to register your interest. You can also follow us on social media to keep up with the project's activities. You've been listening to Microbe Talk. If you like this episode, please like and follow wherever you're listening.